We're all in uncharted territory looking for ways to support our communities. At Dell Technologies, we're making sure small businesses have the right tech solutions. Dell Technologies advisors are here for you, from helping small businesses stay connected and productive while working remotely with Windows 10 and Microsoft Teams, to rapidly deploying remote work solutions that limit upfront costs with Dell Financial Services. We're standing by you every step of the way. Call 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL.
This is the best of Golic and Wingo podcast.
Aren't we all? Glad you're with us. Golic and Wingo, ESPN Radio and ESPN 2. We are presented by Progressive Insurance. All phone guests join us. Penzo Performance Line. Look, it's Mike Golic. Look, it's Mike Golic Jr. with just blazing shoes today. Incredible. Incredible.
Saw John Mayer wear these in a concert, bring it all full circle. So
I mean, wow. Friday.
John tends to always get the good Nike stuff before it comes
you
out.
Think?
Surprise, the rich, wealthy celebrity is going to have all the shoes I want.
I've never heard of that happening before.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Friday, you blinded us with thigh meat, and now you are just killing us with these fluorescent moon shoes.
Right. Now, listen, I'm taking advantage of the opportunity to show my feet on TV. What
just
a time.
Just the joy of actually watching live sports over a weekend, huh?
How about that?
Wow.
As we had not only the NASCAR continuing to travel around to different tracks, but we also had the PGA Tour back for the first time since the hard pause in March.
91 days.
Yeah.
91 days, but who's counting?
Yeah, I can say it's
yeah. We all are.
It sounds amazing because I talked about someone of that in reference to their business, and I said the number in the 90s, and it sort of snaps you back into that mindset because it was amazing how comfortable it already felt having golf back again yesterday.
Yeah.
Like, it felt like we hadn't missed a beat. It felt like it all came back at once, which was not what I expected to feel when I sat down.
I'm telling you, the amazing thing to me, because I saw a lot of it this weekend because there was not much to watch, but I do enjoy watching golf. But between the second round and the third round, I mean, it was a star-studded, I mean, from DeChambeau to Justin Rose to Xander Schauffele, Patrick Reed, Bubba Watson, Gary Woodland. I mean, Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas. The names at the top were like, oh, my God. I mean, this is going to be awesome. And then Daniel Berger beats Colin Morikawa in a playoff. Berger, it's his third win. Oh, by the way, wait till you see the dates of his third win. It's unbelievable. But, I mean, that's the two that end up in the playoffs, and the name guys gack it up before to try and get into the playoffs. It was unreal.
Rory shot a 41.
Oh, my gosh.
Put that in perspective. I shot a 41 on the front nine Sunday.
Wasn't Rory sick? Supposedly he was under the weather.
Yeah, a little bit.
The weather. So
but before we move on to anything else, we do need to come up with the definitive nickname for the new massive Bryson DeChambeau, right? That has to happen, right? Among the contenders, Gaines Stewart, the Mass-Matician, Bryson DeChambeau, and Jacked Thickness.
You know what? I'm going to work on this through the body of the show now because I didn't realize we were renaming Bryson.
Look at him!
Thanos! He looks like golf's Watt brother. Like, he
I would, because he is the math guy, for those that may not know him in golf, he is the angles math guy,
the protractor.
I mean, he was, and then he realized being strong is way cooler. Yeah. So he
and
just
now
got jacked.
He put on 25 pounds, and he just grips it and rips it. It's unbelievable.
He looks like a cartoon character out there. Yeah. And this is how stupid golf is, okay? Because Bryson DeChambeau is out there looking like Thanos, just jacking drives 360 yards, and he's playing better. Gary Woodland, still the defending U.S. Open champ, has dropped like 15 to 20 pounds, and he's playing better. Golf is just so weird.
Well, how old is Gary Woodland?
Gary's in his early to mid-30s, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Listen, everyone makes their own decisions, but the age-old question has the same answer. It is never wrong to be strong.
It's just so crazy.
He finished just out of the playoffs. Justin Rose just out.
Our guy Harold Varner had a step back on Sunday, but played very well.
Xander Schauffele, but these were guys that just missed the playoffs. Xander Schauffele, after the saves that he had, misses almost a gimme in what we would consider in the friend zone on our weekend golf.
That is always in the friend zone.
I mean, it was unbelievable. He lips it out on 17 and he misses a chance, but congrats to Daniel Berger. because Morikawa missed a gimme putt.
Same green.
Same green on 17. I mean, he missed an absolute. He missed one. There is no shot any of us would putt because one of us would say, that's good. Yeah. We would have picked it up easily. That was in the friend zone by a foot and a half.
Yeah.
And he missed it. And that was it, and Berger gets the win.
Oh, my God. I would say, is there any beer in that cup? Good Lord.
Well, the funny thing is that, you know, there's a part of the Colonial Golf Course called the Horrible Horseshoe where it's a really tough three-hole stretch, and that's exactly what happened on both those two putts. The Horrible Horseshoe putts lipped out on 17. But for Daniel Berger, I guess if he's ever going to win, it's going to be in the first couple of weeks of June.
He has three PGA Tour wins, June 12th, 2016, June 11th, 2017, June 14th this year.
Yeah. I mean, that's just
it
remarkable.
Gets around this time of the year. Watch out. He plays his best. Talk about knowing when a guy's going to peak.
Yeah.
Honestly. Is he married to a Gemini?
Yeah, because normally the other two wins at the St. Jude Classic, which is played the week before the U.S. Open. So twice in the last few years, he's won the warm-up basically to the U.S. Open. Obviously, the schedule is all helter-skelter this year. So he wins this one at Colonial. But again, this was the first time back for the PGA Tour since the hard pause before the second round of the Players' Championship, that week where everything shut down. And after the win, he was on SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt, basically Berger talking about all the protocols and the testing that everybody had to go through to get back out and playing golf.
We had tests when we got on site. We had temperature readings before we got to the course every day. I felt very comfortable with the whole process that the PGA Tour implemented. I think all of the golfers that were here this week felt the same way. Obviously, next week we're going to be doing the same thing, being tested before we get on site. I think they've got a really good plan in place, and you know, as long as nothing changes, I think we're going to be good to go.
You know, we've seen NASCAR follow along, and they've been very, very smooth. And now this was the first one for the PGA, and all seemed to go smooth. And no, again, no fans at this one. NASCAR at Homestead, they had 1,000 invited guests to this one. And I believe the next one, there's supposed to be 5,000 fans. So you start to trickle toward that, a part of it. And that's what they'll do in the PGA. I think they said the first five events in the PGA were going to be without fans. Yep. And then they start letting fans in. So all good on the start of NASCAR, which has been going on since May 17th, and all good with the first one for the PGA.
Well, and we see with NASCAR, like the PGA had some worries because in the practice rounds, they had to tell guys like, hey, listen, we need to put a little space between all this.
Right.
I mean, NASCAR, they're locking drivers in their own little rooms for hours on end before these races get started. So I think one has certainly treated it with a great deal more severity in the run-up as opposed to golf that has a little bit more of a lax feel for all the reasons around the differences between golf and NASCAR, but also, you know, naturally distanced itself in a way it kind of needed a reminder, mind its players of leading up to this.
Well, that's the interesting thing. And Todd Archer, by the way, has a great column up on ESPN.com about no positive tests for anybody related with the tour. But these are two traveling shows now, right? They're going to go from place to place. And that's sort of the thing that's going to be a question mark. But if you're going to look at two sports that could do their thing and social distance, it would be NASCAR.
It would certainly be
golf, right? Because especially when you and I play, you're going left, I'm going right.
Yeah, and the scores were pretty good. But again, golf courses were one of the first things that opened back up. Yeah. So these guys were out practicing, you know, and to be ready for this first competition. Good scores, and congratulations to Daniel Berger.
And then, of course, Denny Hamlin goes on to win at NASCAR. And running back Alvin Kamara of the Saints tweeted some support of Bubba Wallace, and NASCAR invited him down to the race. So Bubba was there, and Alvin Kamara.
I think Bubba took 13th, I think, in this one. Hamlin gets the win, his third one, I believe, this year, and like 3-hour rain delay. It was a long day out there on the track, but Hamlin gets the win.
All right, so congratulations to that as we continue here on a Monday morning. Lots more to get to on Golic and Wingo as we continue to wind and weave our way through what's going on, including some things in the NBA. And Buster Olney will join us, where basically he has a column on ESPN.com where he basically says, it's all the Astros' fault why we don't have this. We'll get to all of that after this.
Golic
and Wingo.
And Wingo.
Mm-hmm. Trey Wingo and Mike Golic Sr. So for more on why we don't have an agreement in baseball and what is actually going to happen, let's bring in our guy, Major League Baseball insider Buster Olney. Buster, why does baseball hate everybody?
Oh, boy, is it maddening. And it was interesting yesterday, you know, hearing from so many people in the rank and file in the game, on the player side, you know, hearing from guys who are not stars – on the baseball side, hearing from folks among the teams, people are just angry within the game that this is not settled, that the two, you know, the leaderships on both sides are still in their bunkers, they're still entrenched, no one's really stepped out significantly the middle ground, and, you know, on the current trajectory, what a mess. Rob implements a short season, say 54 games, and it's on their terms, you do wonder how the players are going to participate. None of these issues are going to be resolved. It's just going to defer some of the larger labor issues into the future, and it might guarantee that 2021 is even going to be uglier than what we have here in terms of these two sides working things out.
Buster, is there one side in all this that you're more upset with?
Well, I personally think that both sides have contributed significantly to this moment. I think the lack of engagement on the Players Association side, Tony Clark, the last 5 years, has manifested to this point and has helped to create the climate for this point because, Major League Baseball, whether it's pace of play initiatives or shoe colorings or, you know, the labor thing, they keep bringing ideas to the table, and basically Tony Clark's strategy has been to say no, 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 obstructionist, and to block them. And they're not building anything in doing that, and I do feel like that their strategy is short-sighted because let's say that the players hold together in this moment. That doesn't make it better for the 300-plus free agents in the fall. You would think that at some point the Player Association would come out and build something going forward. We talked in early May about parlaying their leverage of this moment into something greater. And on the owner's side, and this is mostly what I wrote about on Sunday, it's the same sort of fight for incremental efficiency that we've seen happen with a lot of teams. Jeff Luhnow did this with the Astros. And in this moment, you keep on waiting for somebody to say the house is burning, grab the hose, let's put this thing out, let's put better baseball in a better place. And the owners are certainly at this moment are the side with the ability to do that because they have the greater access to wealth.
So, Buster, I guess as layman terms as you can explain this, where it would seem incremental gives on both sides would get this deal done, why are they not doing it?
Because of the distrust. And because of the suspicion, on Major League Baseball's side, they are absolutely frustrated with the union under Tony Clark's leadership, where they feel like, look, we want to do some horse trading. We want to do some bartering. How come we can't engage more? And I think that frustration has built up so much over the last 5 years. And this is, to me, an absolute worst-case scenario for baseball and for the Players Association, for that matter. If that frustration has gotten to the point where the owners just say, you know what, you guys don't want to deal, you don't want to talk to us, you don't want to engage, then we'll play the long game. And we'll just basically sit in place, and then at some point we're going to get conditions where we can put in a better financial model. That may take a couple of years, but that's where I'm worried that they're sitting right now.
Buster Olney with us. So basically the long game means the shortest possible season, right? So basically Tony Clark and the Players Association has finally said they've thrown it at their hands, which just says, just tell us when to show up. So when we do this and when Rob Manfred implements this season, we believe it'll be around 48 games. What are going to be the long-term ramifications for Major League Baseball doing that?
Oh, boy. Well, first off, as I said, the long-term ramifications are absolute entrenchment when it comes to the labor stuff, because we may, unless there's a coronavirus vaccine, we may be right back in the same place next February as they try to work out terms for a 2021 season. You've got the CBA talks that have to happen next year because the current agreement expires in December 2021. And whatever the ramifications are from any baseball this year will also manifest. Because I got to tell you, conversations with agents, with players, they're mixed on what's going to happen if baseball implements. Because remember, just because they put a system in place, they still would have to work through some safety and health protocol. Different players are going to handle that differently. There's an expectation that some players will opt out. The players could certainly adopt the passive-aggressive approach of, Well, you know what? I don't know if I want to go along with these exact protocol. You might have players decide that, you know, that little injury that they worked through in the past, they wouldn't work through. You might have potential free agents who will essentially protect their own interest and walk away after a few days or a few games, or, you know, hide behind an injury, hide behind coronavirus concern, whatever it is. That's the thing. If there's no collaboration, there's no cooperation, there's no telling how ugly a short season would play out.
Buster Olney with us here on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. Buster, all of this as the backdrop, and then you get the announcement just, I think, yesterday or the day before, Major League Baseball reaching a $1 billion deal with Turner Sports to air playoff games. How does that factor into all of this?
Oh, boy. Well, it certainly, and I think what happened was in the middle of May, the end of May, there were moderates on the player side who felt like that they could gain some traction to working to find some middle ground. But then when the owner's initial offer came out, you guys remember that, where you had that sliding scale for players where the highest paid players would make 20% of their prorated salary. That's when the feeling among the moderates was, man, they just coalesced what's referred to as the Scott Boras wing. You know, that group of players who are advocating, we need full prorated salaries. And then as each offer has come out from the owner since then, it hasn't really moved the needle that much. The players have coalesced, and I think that that leaked story over the weekend that TBS and Major League Baseball have an agreement that you know, nets Major League Baseball about $1 billion in future earnings. Again, that served to coalesce the players, because so many of them over the weekend tweeted out, look at this, yeah, baseball doesn't have access to money. You know, Bill DeWitt, the Cardinals owner, saying last week that, you know, the baseball is not a real profitable sport. That flew in the face of that, and the timing could not have been worse, I think, for baseball, Major League Baseball, as the players are pulling together.
Buster, a lot of this goes back to this March agreement between the union and baseball. And basically, it seems like the only thing written in stone there that everybody agrees to, that Rob Manfred has the ability to implement the number of games if nothing works out. Your understanding, we've gotten bits and pieces of that agreement. From that agreement, are the players right in what they're doing and saying there was nothing in there that says we have to negotiate salaries? Or do you think the owners are right in saying once there were no fans, we said we were going to negotiate salaries?
And Golic, that is the absolute bottleneck of where we are at this moment. That agreement on March 26, as we heard from Tony Clark and from Scott Boras shortly thereafter, you know, the understanding is the players are going to get full prorated salaries. Right away when they were saying those things, I was hearing from people on Major League Baseball side saying, no, that's not at all what that agreement said. Then in late May, Joel Sherman of the New York Post wrote a story publishing some internal documentation that supported the owner's position on that. And on the other side, you had players like Max Scherzer coming out and saying, no, the owners have offered us that we're going to get full prorated salaries. You had Andrew McCutchen on Friday mentioning this was the juice that the owners promised the players. That is, to this moment, there's a disagreement over what's in that March 26 document. And here's the thing, as I've heard from people on both sides, the fact that there's not absolute clarity about what was supposed to happen if they're not fans in the stands, whether it's to revisit the terms or, in fact, the players are going to get full prorated salaries, the fact that is still not clear to everybody, crystal clear, falls on the lawyers who wrote this agreement. And they feel like this was an absolute failure, that not everybody is on the same page, because that is the sticking point.
All right, before we get on to something slightly more pleasant, Buster, is there any part of you that says they'll actually come to an agreement or this will just be forced down the players' throats?
I don't think there's going to be an agreement. There's no trust whatsoever. Guys, when they have been having these exchanges in recent weeks, they're not even talking. Like, it's the way that these exchanges are happening is we get the leak from either side to the media, and then eventually the actual documentation, the actual offer, is then forwarded to the other side. Right now there are no Zoom calls, there are no phone calls. They're just firing off documents into social media. That's how these things are happening. And given the level of distrust and suspicion that's built up over the non-cooperation, non-collaboration over the last 5 years, I don't think there's going to be an agreement.
All right, Buster, let's go to something that was really fun to watch, even though it's tainted now. But I don't care. It was so much fun to watch back in 1998. Long gone summer last night, our 30 for 30 on ESPN. Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, the race that went on. Just take us back to that year. I know expectations were high for McGwire because he had 58 the year before. But just take us to that year and that race and your remembrance of it.
You know, I was covering the Yankees in the summer of 98 for the New York Times, but one weekend they sent me to St. Louis to work on a piece about the excitement over batting practice. And boy, was that absolutely the case. Like, it was the first time where people, they were opening up the gates early and they were letting fans in because everyone wanted to watch Mark McGwire take batting practice. The same thing with Sammy Sosa. I did a piece that was posted on .com last Friday. There were 17 pitchers that allowed home runs to both guys that year. I talked with five of them, and those guys were talking about being excited about it. You know, Rick Reed of the Mets talking about how he would rush out the door to make sure that he'd be in the ballpark if one of them happened to be taking early batting practice because he wanted to watch it. Jason Barre actually told me a story about how typically he would hit, he would take batting practice in the group just after McGwire, and on the day he pitched, he wouldn't go out there because he was like, I did not want that mental image in my head before I pitched against him. But on the other day, sure, he was out in the dugout watching that show. There was a lot of excitement. And I remember being around McGwire for those few days. I remember how onerous it was for him. Like, he didn't look like he was having any fun whatsoever, you know, dealing with hordes of reporters like myself. And I really feel like it wasn't until Sammy entered the race with that 20 home runs in June that Mark really began to have fun. It would not have been a fun thing for McGwire if not for the interaction that we started to see with Sammy as we went down the stretch.
No, you're 100% right. And then, you know, because like you said, Golic, he had 58 the year before. Everyone thought it was either be Griffey or McGwire to maybe potentially break the record. Sammy came out of nowhere. And Buster, the thing that stuck with me, and we talked to Tony La Russa about this last week, is that he actually went into the last weekend of the series down to Sammy Sosa. Even though he broke the record first, he could have broken the record and still not held the record. And to come up with five that last weekend was absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, and he, in that year, and just in talking with those pitchers, they talk about how with McGwire, you know, you could get him to chase up in the strike zone. And they thought that that year he was so locked in. You know, one thing that you know he would do when he would get in the on-deck circle, he wouldn't take any swings, guys. He would just stand there and he would visualize and he would lock in. And look, he, in my opinion, should be in the Hall of Fame. He was a Hall of Fame caliber player for a lot of years. But he was at his absolute apex in how locked in he was that year. And I'd say this, too, you know, just being around covering the sport since 1989, the backdrop of it all you wondered about was PEDs. And just as a reporter covered at that time, you know, you always tried to figure out how you were going to get at that issue. But I think the context is important. Look, those two guys, you know, and McGwire's acknowledged it, Sammy hasn't. There were thousands of players using under the baseball umbrella, minor leaguers, major leaguers. I've always thought that Sosa, McGwire, Clemens, Bonds got the most scrutiny because they were the best players, but they were hardly, you know, the only guys who might have been using that.
100% true. No doubt about that. All right, lastly, Buster, next year, this is why we get to play the hypothetical game. Yeah. Everything runs smoothly. There's peace between the two. We have a 162-game schedule. It's a regular, normal season next year, and one player hits over 60 home runs. Who is it?
Mike Trout, who just gets better and better and better at understanding and pitch recognition and pitch discipline. It's incredible watching his career play out, how it's like going up the side of a pyramid. And here's the thing, that lineup that they have now with the Angels, the addition of Anthony Rendon, the maturation of Shohei Ohtani, that's where more protection steps in for him. He gets more pitches to hit, and he's the guy who challenges the record.
We'll see what happens, awesome. And we'll see when Major League Baseball forces
what
a 48-game schedule.
What a dream that would be, Golic. You're talking yeah. about fantasy. Everything would be still in the Middle East, too.
Yeah, a pipe dream at this point.
Let's all go away with smiles.
There you
here,
go.
Huh?
Buster, we'll talk to you later. Thanks, brother. Appreciate you.
Thanks, guys.
Golic.
I tell you what, a great sports night last night. Yeah. No doubt about it.
And Wingo.
What a day, what a show, what a time.
One, two, three, four.
Field Minister Yates. Field, good morning. How are you, my friend?
Guys, I am contemplating retirement right now because if I do, I'm going out on top after that introduction. I have never been more humbled and honored than that. Amazing.
Well, we're glad you're with us. So before we get into a bunch of stuff that happened over the weekend, today is 1 month, like June 15th. July 15th is the deadline for those given the tag to either sign the tag or get a deal done and figure it all out. So where are we with the one guy we've been talking about for, it seems like, 73 years now, Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott?
Well, Trey, normally I'd tell you that, hey, we're a month away, and it's going to be a long month, and we're going to have to drag through the details and every single day discussing what's going to happen with Dak, and I would say that's kind of a boring or bad thing. But given the sports climate right now and that we are just beginning to have some live sports events, it might actually be a good thing that I anticipate that Dak's contract negotiations will go right until the buzzer, which is not uncommon, but I think July 15th is the time at which we will start to really have some concrete news about Dak. If a deal gets done, I don't personally anticipate it getting done until much closer until the deadline. We've heard about some of the most important sticking points, including the fact that Dak wants a 4-year contract extension. The Cowboys want to do a 5-year deal, which is much more in line with some of their contracts that they've previously handed out to star players on extensions that typically are around 7 years in length. So I know it sounds like a small detail, given the fact that we're talking about the franchise quarterback and all of the other implications of this contract. But if Dak wants that and he's got the leverage, he's going to hold out for that.
Either way, I mean, real quickly, because we definitely want to move on, if they don't get a deal done, you do believe he'll play on the franchise tag?
Yeah, if they don't get a deal done, he'll play it on the franchise tag, and I think he's going to have a Kirk Cousins-like amount of leverage. If he's a free agent next offseason, I expect him to sign a deal that is borderline record-setting. We'll see because of Patrick Mahomes, but if Dak Prescott plays out on the franchise tag, and barring an injury or some sort of complete nosedive and overall play, Dak is going to be sitting so incredibly pretty next offseason, either as a free agent or a third franchise tag player. Second franchise tag player, excuse me.
That is hopefully play on the field. And then there's what may be going on around the games. And some of the latest has been both Baker Mayfield and J.J. Watt talked about the fact that they would kneel if kneeling was still going to be used as the peaceful protest coming in the season, this upcoming season. What are your thoughts on that and what the reaction may be because of it?
Guys, what I'm looking out for over the next couple of months is whether the NFL addresses this with players and teams specifically. If they specifically say, we support players kneeling during the national anthem, because they can talk in more generalities. But let's be honest, one of the most poignant parts of what happened with Colin Kaepernick 4 years ago, probably, I mean, the most poignant part, right, is that people don't necessarily remember all of the words that he spoke. Heck, people are constantly misremembering what Colin Kaepernick knelt during the national anthem for, but they know that he was on a knee during the national anthem. So I think the NFL needs to address, or I think it'd be interesting to see if they do address it with their players, because if they don't, then I wonder what kind of conversation will surround it, because I don't think it's just Baker Mayfield. I don't think it's possibly J.J. Watt. I think it's going to be a huge, huge number of players. It wouldn't surprise me if almost all players are on a knee in a sign of solidarity. The ball is rolling in a way that it was not 4 years ago, where taking a knee could have, I think, resulted in major repercussions that some players maybe weren't comfortable dealing with. I think this time around, in 2020, it's a whole different narrative. So I think the NFL may want to address it with its players, because that sort of helps everybody understand what they should expect if they do take a knee and if there are going to be any sort of consequences, which I think would be a ridiculous thing if there were.
talking to Field Yates with us here on Golic and Wingo. And Field, when we say the NFL, when Greg Popovich comes out and slams Roger Goodell, the commissioner, we're really talking about the 31 and, you know, owners and the Packers situation in this. And I'd be curious, we heard from the Titans principal ownership in this, but outside of that, there haven't been a lot of statements from on high there. Are you surprised that in a time period where everyone has put out some sort of statement about this, the NFL owners have been sort of allowed to skate?
Not really. Well, I am not surprised they haven't said much. I am a little surprised that they've been allowed to skate. And I think that there's a chance that soon enough we'll start to hear from owners or ownership groups or people in positions of high authority within NFL franchises. And I kind of wonder if, like, once one person says something, if all of a sudden others just sort of join the party and this becomes a little bit of a domino effect. But I'm with you. It is the, you know, silence can be deafening, right? And right now that's the, you know, that's what we have with NFL owners, is that the commissioner has released a statement or released the video. We've seen, you know, the faces of the league, or at least almost all of the most important faces of the league, you know, have said something, where there's a video that highlighted, you know, whatever it was, close to a dozen or more of the most prominent black players in the NFL speaking out. At some point, you realize that the owner's not saying something, like they can't just hide for much longer. And I know that we're not in season, and perhaps that decreases visibility compounded with COVID. But at some point, you know, people need to hear from not just the power players, almost all ownership groups, but certainly the guys or the groups that we consider, you know, sort of the people that in some ways make the most important forces behind the league.
Field Yates with us this morning, and we'll see how that plays out going forward. Meanwhile, we talked about Dak Prescott still not signed to a contract. Cam Newton still not signed by anybody. There was that video he put out of him working with Odell Beckham Jr. What are you hearing in terms of where Cam may be headed right now, or is it going to be a training camp injury situation for him?
Yeah, I don't think there's a specific team that anybody has heard of substance that he could be headed to. What I do think is that while I think there, if Cam wanted a deal comparable to Andy Dalton or Jameis Winston, and I don't necessarily mean financially, I mean in terms of, hey, you're taking a deal because you're the clear-cut backup to our quarterback, and if something happens, we're glad to have you, but for now, don't make any, you know, mistakes about it. You are number two. I think that could be available to Cam right now. I just don't know that Cam wants that, right? And can you blame that, right? Like, can you blame him for that, Cam? Yeah. Once the NFL MVP, one of the most dynamic players we've ever seen at the quarterback spot. Now, at the same time, you could argue, hey, Cam, listen, you're coming off of a foot issue. You've had a shoulder issue and foot issue. You're not the same player you once were, I would say, necessarily. I mean, you're not a massive decline physically, but you're not quite the same level of physical specimen you were at one point earlier in your career. And the market's not great, right? There's just nobody who needs a starting quarterback right now. So I think Cam will, as you said, Trey, maybe buy some time for himself and not hope that someone gets hurt, but if someone does get hurt, be the quarterback that's ready, willing, and able to step in and be someone that can help, you know, save a season. If a team thinks they're going to be a playoff contender because of their starting quarterback and he goes down, Cam is the, you know, the safety net. He is the guy that could potentially come in and resurrect those playoff hopes.
All right, Field, you mentioned the name, so I have to bring it up with you. Jameis Winston, recently he said he believes he's one of the best quarterbacks to ever play in the NFL. Thoughts?
You know something, Trey? You guys know, I'll mix it up on Twitter and have some fun with these kind of comments. They're sort of in my wheelhouse, right? Like, how do you spin that comment off with a little bit of a joke and have some fun with it? And yet, I found myself saying, I actually love it from Jameis, and here's the reason why. Jameis, the NFL basically viewed Jameis as a player who needs to find his way. Jameis is not old news, but a player that the entire NFL had a chance to canvas and evaluate and offered the opportunity to sign as a potential starting quarterback. And not that the entire NFL needed one, but, you know, there were, what, 13, 14 teams this offseason you could have made the case for, should have been in the quarterback market. And all Jameis Winston could get was a contract that pays him $910,000 in a base salary this year. The NFL does not believe in Jameis Winston right now. So the fact that Jameis believes in himself, I believe, is the first step towards others being able to believe in him as well. If he's not going to play with the confidence needed, then another suitor or any suitor for him is not going to believe and see him as a potential starter down the line. There are enough traits that Jameis, I think, can be remolded into a good player. There are some major, major issues, make no mistake about that. But I like the mindset for right now. What's he got to lose? I mean, honestly, if he is playing this year, it's because Drew Brees is hurt. And if Jameis just gets back to where we saw him in earlier stages of his career, Jameis Winston, or earlier Jameis Winston, plus this Saints roster, is still a very, very, very good team.
Certainly is, and I thought it was interesting, so I wanted to ask you about it. All right, Field, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks, brother.
Thanks, Field.
Guys, take care.
Is your money not sure what to do with itself right now? At Ally, they'll help it save for the future with their smart savings tools. Bucket your money for the things that matter most. Analyze your spending and save automatically. All on top of a competitive rate. For all things money, you deserve an Ally. Visit ally.com/savings for more info. Ally, do it right. Ally Bank, member FDIC.
Though we're apart these days, we're sharing more. So at Geico, we'd like to say thanks. Thanks for sharing your savage dance moves. Thanks for sharing your DIY haircut fails. Thanks for sharing your inner lip sync star. Now it's our turn to share with the Geico Give Back, a 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers. Because we're committed for the long haul, the 15% credit lasts your full policy term. Visit geico.com/giveback for more info and eligibility.
Golic and Wingo.
It was all sort of one big giant jello mold.
Very interesting where that went.
Michael Wilbon. Michael, thanks for joining us this morning. I guess first and foremost, where are you in what you're hearing from players like Kyrie Irving and Dwight Howard who are suddenly saying, hold up, is it really in our best interest to go back and play basketball right now because they're afraid it would take the focus off what has been the attention of most people in this country right now is the fact that the social injustices that have been done against people of color in this country, specifically by people by members of the police.
Well, good morning first. I'm in a place where I needed to listen to people last night who have more credibility, and I know that sounds harsh, but that's how I mean it, with me and most of the basketball world, and Kyrie Irving and Dwight Howard. They're not going to be my discussion leaders. And they may be the discussion leaders. I got to hear from some other people who are less agenda-driven than those two often seem to be. But in listening to others, one of the things they're saying too, the people I'm listening to are, listen, Kyrie Irving and Dwight Howard cannot frame this discussion, but this discussion is a lot larger than them. The discussion is serious. It's more than just, oh, here's somebody agitating for a conference call. People are questioning. One of the things and there are two different dynamics going on, at least. One is the exact social justice piece of this that you mentioned. And the other is the execution of the bubble. Like, can it be done in the way that have been that the league and the players project, anticipate? You know, that's the goal they've set, but how reasonable is that? Charles Barkley gave voice to this over a month ago. And Charles and I have both been here in Arizona since, for the whole pandemic, essentially. And we have talked. And one evening, I listened to Charles because I kept saying, Chuck, what are you doing? They're going to play, and you're saying you wouldn't do this. And it's one of those conversations, I know you guys have had them, where you listen to somebody who really has sat and thought about what seems to be the opposing view. You know, it's not the popular view, and it's somebody going the other way. And Charles ticked off about 8 or 9 reasons in bullet point form as to why he would not restart the season. And I remember at the end of it just saying, damn, you know, this is an incredibly persuasive argument. And at the time, George Floyd had not been murdered yet. That's come up since the NBA has announced its restart. But now, so you've got that piece and you've got, the original thought of, wait a minute, I mean, the bubble sounds nice, but how are you going to do this? And so players were talking all along. This is not like baseball where you have these two sides and it's protracted disagreement over money. Players have been talking all along, and some guys were not in favor of it all along. And now you have that growing chorus since the 2 weeks that have changed the world. And the NBA is caught in it, and I don't know where it's going from here.
Well, Patrick Beverley seems to think he knows, because a lot of people that were talking publicly, and Patrick Beverley, basically, I'm paraphrasing, said, we haven't heard from LeBron, but whatever LeBron says basically goes. How true do you think that statement is?
Yeah, I saw that tweet. Yeah, I saw that tweet. Look, I've been waiting for someone of real impact, influence, from the Lakers or the Clippers or the Raptors or the Bucks. Teams that have, that know, their players know, they have a real shot or feel that way. What are their players saying? And again, I know Dwight Howard's on the Lakers. It's interesting because you see that underline all last night. I was watching, you know, stuff on the network, God knows, at 4 o'clock this morning. And the underline, Lakers not fractured. And they're like, wait a minute, Dwight Howard is going the other way. Because when it comes to influence, Dwight Howard doesn't really have that much. And so not anymore, not now, if he ever did, in terms of these kind of weighty issues. So I want to hear from but Pat Beverly's tweet. I remember I nodded last night to say, amen, I think that's right. But, you know, LeBron's got to be on some of these calls. He knows what's going on. What, you know, I mean, I'm not the only one who's having his mind, if not changed, certainly just given pause to say, okay. And I agree philosophically with what Austin Rivers had to say. When he said, wait a minute, we can call more attention to our cause here, social injustice, to that part of the agenda by playing. And so he disagreed fundamentally, and I agree fundamentally and philosophically with Austin Rivers. But it's more complex than that.
It certainly is, Michael. And as Michael Wilbon joins us here on Golic and Wingo, what you brought up is how long that this had been going on, even back before the murder of George Floyd. But the vote by the NBA Players Association took place after that. And I'm still wondering, and I'm not sure if you have any inkling as to why these issues weren't voiced louder by the players before that vote took place. Why?
I don't know what date. Do you know what date that vote took place?
I want to say it was about a week ago, around June 5th.
Was it a week ago? I mean, but look, every day, this moves. It moves the world. I mean, I don't remember where we were, you know, like if we were 3 days removed from seeing that video, like where were we in this timeline at the time? And again, players were all along, players were talking, and players were talking with Adam. Silver, you know, with Michelle Roberts. I mean, it's not like they just sort of came together at the beginning of a season. And so we sort of advanced to a place slowly. I mean, who in the world knew where we were going to wind up with this? But first of all, we still know we're going to wind up with it. Who in the world knew we'd get to this point? So, okay, the vote may have been taken, but the conversation, it didn't end with that. And I don't think the conversation can end. One of the things we're talking about now is tough conversations. Well, the NBA's having one now. And again, it doesn't just relate to the aftermath of George Floyd. The bubble, again, I had people tell me at the time, and talk to Adam Silver. People I know had Adam's ear on this. And we know that Adam had some trepidation at the beginning because he said, if we're going to shut it down for one positive test, then we can't go down that road. So this was out there anyway. This conversation was out there, and prominent people of the NBA community were having it. But you know what? Just like everything else, why did states reopen when they did? Money. People needed to work. That's the primary reason. The byproduct is, they went to beaches and they went to restaurants again, and now we've got these spikes from sea to shining sea in this country. Why did that happen? Money. The NBA doesn't want to lose. I don't know what the numbers are. You hear all kinds of stuff, you know, paybacks, whatever, $600 million, $700 million. Once again, hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm not going to be flip and say, that can't be the driving determinant. The hell of that? It always is.
Right.
So look at baseball. Baseball is just on the front end, and it's contentious in a way that that people just don't want to stomach. Basketball's now is a different. I'm not even gonna call it a disagreement, even though people are on opposite sides. They're gonna have to talk this out, and I don't know where they go from here. I don't know if it's as simple as, wait a minute, we've still got a majority of the players, and we got the most powerful players, and we're gonna power this through. And if they do, is that the smart thing? I don't know that it is.
Well, there's a conversation they're going to need to have, and we're still trying to figure out whether or not baseball will actually ever have a face-to-face conversation with each other, or it will be unilaterally imposed on the players. This is what we're playing, and then that will lead to all kinds of issues going forward. So let's focus on something that I know you were caught your eye and were a big part of. We saw Long Gone Summer last night, the 30 for 30, on the Sosa-McGuire home run chase of 1998. As someone who is from Chicago and is such a Cubs fan, to live through that, especially that moment in June, because it really was McGuire and Griffey, and then Sammy in today's parlance said, "Hold my beer," and went 20 strong in that 1 month of June, and that really sort of jump started the whole thing, which led to the 70 and 66. That was the flashpoint when Sammy jumped into this thing and said, "Hey, wait a minute, there's a 3-party system here now."
You know, I was thinking about it because of the way we now view that summer as opposed to when it was happening.
Right.
I've put that on the back shelf. I mean, of my Chicago, you know, fanatic memories and the things I was there for, I don't even like that is even it isn't among the, you know, it's not up there with the 6 Bulls championships. We just relived that. It's not up there with the Bears of 85. It's not up there with the Cubs of, you know, but yet at the time, Tony and I talked about this Friday, and I think the question was, given what we know now, is it okay still to celebrate 98, the summer of 98? And our answers were kind of like, my heart wasn't in it. And so when I watched last night, I remember I was a newlywed, and I remember telling my wife, who didn't grow up with baseball in Washington, because she's of an age where she didn't have baseball in Washington. I said, we're going to get on a plane today on a Saturday morning. I'm recalling the Cubs, buying a couple of tickets, and it's an hour and a half flight from D.C., and it was a 1:30 game, and we woke up early, and I said, we're going to Wrigley Field today. We're going to watch Sosa. We're going to watch Sammy Sosa, and we're going to hope he hits a home run, because this is the greatest thing. And so it reminded me last night, this thing I put aside, because of what came from it ultimately, was thrilling. And I was at the game covering the game for the Washington Post, where McGuire hit 62. But there's so many things I forgot. Like, I didn't realize that McGuire, who was so uncomfortable, and that wasn't highlighted nearly enough for me. It was mentioned. And La Russa at one point says, thank God that Sosa was at these joint press conferences, because Mark wanted none of this. There was a reference or two to it, but it wasn't really captured to my liking. But McGuire was so good to Sosa. They were so good to each other. And we looked the Last Dance, and we saw that as great as that was, people weren't always great with each other. These guys were look, the Cardinals and the Cubs, my God, the Cardinals and the Cubs, that's like Packers Bears. That is so much deeper, and there's so much more hatred there for 100 years than Bulls Pistons. And yet those two guys, and so I think we went to a Cardinals Cubs game at Wrigley, and I just said, we're going to see this. And we went as fans to see it. I made her go. And so I think I'm sure it was her first trip to Wrigley Field. So we have to consume this race. But then, you know, at the end of it, I'm still going. I felt good. It was like the season itself. I felt good for 2 hours watching it. And now I'm like, Sammy's not even welcome. He hasn't been to Wrigley Field.
Yeah, that's crazy. That makes no sense.
Last night, the first night, I felt bad about that. I went to bed feeling awful that Sammy Sosa has been like in exile. I mean, it's like he's Bartman. And of course, people don't even remember he was on the team in 2003. He had his best seasons already. Retired that trade a year later, but man, I don't know what to make of it. I don't know how to get my arms around it even now.
Yeah, I just remember it was so much fun, and we know what it is and what it wasn't, but it was still just such a blast. Mike, we appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
You got it, guys. Much more next. Golic and Wingo, ESPN Radio, ESPN2.
Golic and Wingo.
Let's not expect too much. There's only one person out there that's expecting way too much out of this guy too early. We know who that is. It's his father.
So for more on that, we're delighted to be joined by our NBA senior insider, Adrian Wojnarowski, and, of course, the host of the Woj Pod. Woj, thanks for being with us. We know you and Ramona just posted a story on ESPN.com. Where are we on these discussions taking place, and what are the odds that it might really put a pause on what we thought was set in stone already, the resumption of the NBA season?
Hey, guys. I'll start with the second question first. I don't think there is any traction or movement or enough support among players to not play that would derail the restart of the league. I think there are individual players who may decide not to play for a variety of reasons, some of which might be the social injustice, Black Lives Matter movement, and a belief that they could do more, or that they prefer to be outside of the bubble at this time in this country's history. I think some might stay out for economic reasons. I think some may stay out because they could potentially be a free agent or have a contract extension and risk injury. And even then, I think those are going to be pretty limited numbers. I think the bigger discussion, guys, among players is, once we do return to play, how can we best leverage the platform, the eyes of the world, the television eyes, certainly, on the league, and to be able to advance this movement? And, you know, Ramona talked to Michelle Roberts in the piece that we reported out today, and she talked about that, and you see her talking about advancing that conversation. She used the example, she said, with some players about Tommy Smith and John Carlos in 1968 in Mexico City, and how they, by competing and winning, instead standing on the medal stand, how that they were able to, you know, dramatically impact the world. And that was an example she used. And I think the players that I've talked to, largely, and agents who represent significant numbers of players, the Players Association, I think that is the crux of the conversation right now.
Adrian Wojnarowski joining us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. So since that call where Kyrie brought this up, and we've heard some statements from current players like he and Dwight Howard and some former players, how important is the next statement, the inevitable statement from LeBron James?
Well, I mean, listen, LeBron carries more weight than any player in the league. He's the most influential player, maybe in professional sports. I don't think that overstates it. Certainly in the NBA. And I think among the players of LeBron's elite tier, the all NBA superstars, certainly, especially those on teams who are competing for a championship, who are the contenders, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, Anthony Davis, LeBron James, they're all determined to play and plan to play. Again, I think the reasons some may not play, there's a variety of reasons. There's the bubble environment and how restrictive and isolating that environment's going to be for 6-7 weeks for some players, for more for others, based on how far they advance. But there's no question LeBron's voice carries great sway. I think he's made it clear where he stands, that he wants to play, he wants to compete for a championship, and then he wants to use the platform in Orlando to be able to speak to the issues of social injustice, of Black Lives Matter, and he's done that often in his career in a lot of different ways, on the floor, away from the floor. And I think people know where he stands right now, that he'll he'll use Orlando and use the restart to be able to do that. And I think the league is allowing the Players Association to take the lead on that and look at how they would like to do that. And I think the league has shown, you know, generally in history to be supportive of it.
Woj, I'm curious. All of this discussion is understandable and worthwhile, and like you said, may move towards the truest solution of how to use the platform in all of this as best they possibly can. Are people surprised that this conversation is taking place after the NBAPA had ratified the plan to come back and not before all of that discussion?
Well, I think it's certainly escalated since the vote. I think, but also, to be fair, I think at the time of the vote, certainly, you know, the George Floyd murder in Minneapolis had happened, and the country, there was a movement well underway centered on what they've been speaking about this weekend. I think where people look at the timing is, I think Kyrie Irving's involvement, because he's a vice president in the Players Association. You know, I had reported on Friday that, you know, it was a week ago Friday that they had their vote and a call to discuss, you know, essentially ratifying the 22 team return. And he was on the call. He had not addressed any of these issues on the call. He had asked some other questions that were more, I think, more procedural to what the return would look like. And then soon after, you know, this became, you know, he had been starting to engage with other players in the league. And so Kyrie Irving was not the only player in the league who wanted to talk about this, who was talking about this. I think the hard part, guys, is, you know, it's like any other players association or union. You elect teams, elect player representatives, and then there's an executive committee. And, you know, ultimately the voting is done not by 450 members, but team representatives were the ones who voted on that call. There had been meetings between the Players Association, like Zoom calls, like an hour each with each team laying out these details. But I think at different times, you know, it's hard with the union because you've got players at the very top who are making, who are max contract star players. There are players at the bottom in the middle whose careers are in different places, and younger, older players. So you're just going to have a lot of viewpoints, a lot of perspectives. Some of them are isolated to individual people, but most of them overlap. And I think there are a lot of issues. It is social injustice. It is the bubble. It is the risk of injury. I reported on Saturday about Donovan Mitchell and Jason Tatum and De'Aaron Fox, that group of players, Bam Adebayo, who are up for rookie contract extensions this year, hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts, who were talking to the Players Association about wanting, through the league, some insurance protection because they feel, and rightfully so, I think, that they are taking there's a higher risk of injury, maybe even serious injury, because of the layoff and then a shortened training camp. And so those are all the conversations that are going on here.
Adrian Wojnarowski with us, joining us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. And Woj, then there's just the simple logistics, right? The NBA is going to release two documents to teams sometime this week, according to some of your sources. A side letter of agreement to changes in the collective bargaining agreement to accommodate the 22 team restart to the season, and then a 125-page health and safety manual detailing the step-by-step protocols from June workouts all the way through playoff games in October in Orlando. So there still seems to be a lot of information that needs to be processed here for people to understand how this is all going to work.
I would say, Trey, I think a lot of the information, almost all of it that's been in there, has been shared with the players, the teams. Like, we've been reporting on the elements of these for weeks. Many of them have been agreed to for a while. You know, in the story today, we had, you know, a couple new elements with some contract bonuses and those things. But in terms of the health and safety, like, there's not going to be any revelations in that document where players are going to be, oh, we didn't realize this. They realize that it's mostly like a lot of, I'm told, just guidelines on cleaning and disinfecting and all the things you've got to do. The distance, there's a lot to it. There's more to it. I don't mean to oversimplify it, but the contents of that have been almost entirely shared with everybody. There's no surprises coming out of that. Players know what the quarantine situation is going to be. They know that they cannot have guests come into the bubble until after the first round of the playoffs. And so while it will be, you know, it's really more of a document for the team executives and the teams who are just learning, just to fully understand everything that goes into getting their teams to Orlando.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate the help and the update, Woj. Obviously, we'll be looking out from you, Ramona, and others as all of the situation continues to progress. Thanks for the time, Woj.
Thanks, Woj. Thanks, buddy.
I appreciate it, guys. Talk to you soon.
Golic.
Makes me want to vomit and then punch you square in the face.
And Wingo.
Oh, he's saucy today. And that someone else is a former teammate of LeBron James, and that's Kendrick Perkins, who's with us this morning. Kendrick, thanks for being with us. Obviously, a lot of discussion about the discussion that some NBA players are having, and a lot of people are waiting to hear what LeBron might have to say on that. How important do you think his voice is will be on this discussion about should something disrupt the idea of going forward and resuming the NBA season in Orlando?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. Second of all, listen, the NBA is coming back. I don't know, you know, these group of guys that got on this phone conversation. You know, they had their chance, you know, a week or two ago when they first had a conference call and the voting was, I believe, 28 to nothing that guys wanted to come back. You know, you look at this situation at hand right now, and what it's doing is it's causing – conflict and confusion between our players. And what it's doing is it's making us not look as one, not unified, because all of a sudden we were told, we all came to, everyone came to agreement that we're going to play. And all of a sudden, you know, one guy is trying to ruffle the feathers and make noise for no reason, because he's not going to move the needle. You know, all the guys that was on that call were the powerful voices of the NBA. LeBron James, Anthony Davis, Luka Doncic, Russell Westbrook, Damian Lillard, you know, Giannis. The list goes on. And the vote was 28-9. Chris Paul, they wanted to play. Now, here it is. Chris Paul is the president of the Players Association, and all of a sudden we come out, we make a final decision, we work hand in hand with the NBA, and the players want to play, the owners want to play, we want to get basketball back. And now here it is, the vice president of the Players Association comes out and all of a sudden ruffles the feathers, saying that he think we shouldn't play. But this was the same guy about 10 days ago that came out and said that he wanted to join the team and be in Orlando around his team because, you know, the agreement was that inactive players couldn't go because there was only a certain amount of people that could be in the bubble. Now, what changed over the last 9-10 days? What changed was, from what I strongly believe and what I heard, is that the NBA and the Players Association told Kyrie that, no, you can't go because we're limited on the number of people that we could take, and the inactive players, knowing that you're not going to play, is although it's a great idea, it just wouldn't be the smartest thing to do. And all of a sudden now you're ruffling the feathers and causing not only friction in the world, but you're causing friction between the NBA brotherhood, because now when guys do get back to playing, you're going to have certain people saying, oh, man, they wrong for that. It's bigger than basketball. When people wasn't saying that at first. And at the end of the day, listen, I'm all for civil rights and I'm all for the right thing, and I do believe that we need change, and we need change fast. We need to stop with the police brutality. We need to stop with the racism. But can we change that overnight? No. And with protesting, I'm not saying don't go out there and protest. I'm saying, you know, let your voices be heard. I speak mine. But at the end of the day, since George Floyd death, we have lost so many lives of so many races that we need to come up with another plan or another solution to the problem, a temporary fix. Because right now, when we announce protesting and we go out and protest to the police officers and to the system, it's almost like we're saying, let's go to war, because that's what's happening right now. But at the end of the day, it's a difference between being powerful and popular. Kyrie is a popular guy, but he's not a powerful guy. He's not moving the needle where the NBA is going to say, oh, now we go cancel the season because Kyrie got 80 guys on the call. That's not happening. It's just not happening. I'm sorry. And I wouldn't be surprised if we wouldn't hear from LeBron James at this time, because there's no reason for him to address this.
We'll see what happens.
Well, I'll tell you what, you answered about every question we had out there, Kendrick. That was a great job.
I was about to say, thank you for running the table. That was incredible.
You did our job for us. That was, we have nothing to add there. It's a great job.
We appreciate the time and the help, Kendrick, as always, man.
Man, I apologize, y'all, but I just got so mad. I got so mad of thinking about it, you know, just for the simple fact that, you know, how can a guy mindset change in 10 days? You know, George Floyd was murdered on the 25th of May. They started protesting the next day. They started rioting the next 2 days. Kyrie mindset just 10 days ago was he wanted to go to Orlando. What changed since then? What changed was that they told him he couldn't go.
Right. Yeah. That's laid it out for us. We appreciate it, Kendrick, very much.
Kendrick, thanks for your time, buddy. We appreciate it, man.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
This has been the Best of Golic and Wingo podcast. You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or just ask your smart speaker to play Golic and Wingo. Plus, you can check the guys out live weekday mornings from 6 to 10 Eastern on ESPN Radio and on ESPN News.